Blog Talk Radio. 1940. Okay, August 1940. And his name was actually, he was born Lev Davidovich Bronstein. Okay. And he was a Russian Bolshevik revolutionary and a Marxist theorist. And so that gives you a little background. I'm reading this from Wikipedia, actually, but Leon Trotsky, but you can actually go to that and get much more information on his life and his childhood and so on. And but of the many, he was a theorist. He opposed Stalin, which was the best thing anybody could do. And he had some radical ideas, and it was his concepts. But I believe, if you can call him that, he was a moderate, but a man of, and also a political theorist. And let us go to that. I want to go to that now, and begin reading the article. What I'm about to read here is. Now, if you're listening to me tonight, you're probably reading the introduction to the show. But the essays that I'm about to read are called "The Bankruptcy of Individual Terrorism" and "Why Marxists Oppose Individual Terrorism." I am not a Marxist, nor do I support communism. However, I believe that Trotsky was correct in his criticism, when you hear these essays, was correct in his criticism of individual terrorism. And I believe there is much truth in what he says, especially when you relate it to today's obsession with the lone gunman and suicide bombers and terrorist actions around the world. The strength of any social and political movement is severely crippled, I believe, by violent individual actions. And the strength of a movement is in its unified belief and commitments to positive political and social change. Those are my words. But this is my firm belief. And let us go now to the first essay. Well, Peter Toff, which was the original author of this, was one of the authors, an introduction to this pamphlet. But I'm going to go straight to Leon Trotsky. I've given enough information. I think his words speak well for himself. Why Marxists oppose individual terrorism? Our class enemies are in the habit of complaining about our terrorism. What they mean by this is rather unclear. They would like to label all activities of the proletariat directed against the class enemy's interests as terrorism. The strike, in their eyes, is a principal method of terrorism. The threat of a strike, the organization of strike pickets, the economic boycott of a slave-driving boss, a moral boycott of a traitor from our own ranks, all this and much more they call terrorism. If terrorism is understood in this way, as an action inspiring fear in or doing harm to the enemy, then of course the whole class struggle is nothing but terrorism. And the only question remaining is whether the bourgeois politicians have the right to pour out their flood of moral indignation about proletarian terrorism when their entire state apparatus, with its laws, police, and army, is nothing but an apparatus for capitalist terror. However, it must be said that when they reproach us with terrorism, they are trying, although not always consciously, to give the word of a narrower, less direct meaning. The damaging of machines by workers, for example, is terrorism in this strict sense of the word. The killing of an employer, or a threat to set fire to a factory, or a death threat to its owner, an assassination attempt with revolver in hand against a government minister, all of these are terrorist acts in the full and authentic sense. However, anyone who has an idea of the true nature of international social democracy ought to know that it has always opposed this kind of terrorism, and does so in the most irreconcilable way. Why? Terrorizing with the threat of a strike, or actually conducting a strike, is something not industrial workers, that is something only industrial workers can do. The social significance of a strike depends directly upon, first, the size of the enterprise or the branch of industry that it affects, and second, the degree to which the workers taking part in it are organized, disciplined, and ready for action. This is just as true of a political strike as it is for an economic one. It continues to be the method of struggle that flows directly from the productive role of the proletariat in modern society. In order to develop the capitalist system needs a parliamentary superstructure. Because it cannot confine the modern proletariat to a political ghetto, or must sooner or later allow the workers to participate in parliament. In elections, the mass character of the proletariat and its level of political development quantities, which again are which are determined by its social role, i.e. above all its productive role, find their expression. As in a strike, so in elections, the method, aim, and result of the struggle always depend on the social role and strength of the proletariat as a class. Only the workers can conduct a strike. Artisans ruined by the factory, peasants whose water the factory is poisoning, or a lumpen proletariats in search of plunder can smash machines, set fire to a factory, or murder its owner. Only the conscious and organized working class can send a strong representation into the halls of parliament to look out for proletarian interests. However, in order to murder a prominent official, you need to have the organized masses behind. The recipe for explosives is accessible to all, and a Browning can be obtained anywhere. In the first case, there is a social struggle, whose methods and means flow necessarily from the nature of the prevailing social order, and in the second, a purely mechanical reaction, identical anywhere in China as in France, very striking in its outward form, murder, explosions, and so forth, but absolutely harmless as far as the social system goes. A strike, even of modest size, has social consequences. Strengthening of the workers' self-confidence, growth of the trade unions, and not infrequently even an improvement in productive technology. The murder of a factory owner produces effects of a police nature only, or a change of proprietors devoid of any social significance. Whether a terrorist attempt, even a successful one, throws the ruling class into confusion depends on the concrete political circumstances. In any case, the confusion can only be short-lived. The capitalist state does not base itself on government ministers and cannot be eliminated with them. The classes it serves will always find new people. The mechanisms remain intact and cannot and continue to function. And I'm basically saying, if you kill somebody, it doesn't change anything. It just makes them mad and more entrenched. But the disarray introduced into the ranks of the working masses themselves by a terrorist attempt is much deeper. It is enough to arm oneself with a pistol in order to achieve one's goal. Why the efforts of a class struggle? If a thimble full of gunpowder and a little chunk of lead is enough to shoot the enemy through the neck, what need is there for a class organization? If it makes sense to terrify highly placed personages with a roar of explosions, where is the need for a party? Why meetings, mass agitation, and elections if one can so easily take aim at a ministerial bench from the gallery of a parliament? In our eyes, individual terror is inadmissible, precisely because it belittles the role of the masses in their own consciousness, reconciles them to their powerlessness, and turns their eyes and hopes toward a great avenger and liberator who someday will come and accomplish this mission. The anarchist prophets of the propaganda of the deed can argue all they want about the elevating and stimulating influence of terrorist acts on the masses. Theoretical considerations and political experience prove otherwise. The more effective the terrorist acts, the greater their impact, the more they reduce the interest of the masses in self-organization and self-education. But the smoke from the confusion clears the way. The panic disappears. The successor of the murdered minister makes his appearance, and life again settles into the old rut. The wheel of capitalist exploitation turns as before, and only the police repression grows more savage and brazen. And as a result, in place of the kindled hopes and artificially aroused excitement come disillusionment and apathy. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. Islamic struggle of terrorism, but also, you know, you have to look at the false flag aspect of this too, because Israel and the United States are both involved up to their necks and their eyeballs in creating this false flag terrorist incidents. Okay, to blame the Muslims for it, to blame the Arabs, and the Arabs are getting pissed off about it. However, you can't deny their frustration, and their great frustration the frustration of the Arabs is, you know, their individuals and their individual groups that are continually blowing themselves up and blowing up installations and so on and so forth. But it doesn't really win, you know, as an individual killing himself. It all it does is it strengthens the police state. It strengthens the. It gives more credence to the terrorist acts. To the, all this Patriot acts and stuff like that. So what Trotsky is saying here makes so much sense. And you know, being Marxist, it's irrelevant. That it's Marxist. The fact is that. He's declaring basic truth, you know, and as he says, as the result, in place of the kindled hopes and artificially aroused excitements, comes disillusionment and apathy. People just shrug in wonderment and say, "What this craziness going on? You know, how can we support any kind of organization that would blow itself up and blow its people up and blow innocent people up and kill people and just, you know, for the sake of what, you know? And Trotsky goes on to say, the efforts of reaction to put an end to strikes and to the mass workers movement in general have always everywhere ended in failure. Capitalist society needs an active, mobile, and intelligent proletariat. It cannot, therefore, bind the proletariat hand and foot for very long. On the other hand, the anarchist propaganda of the deed has shown every time that the state is much richer in the means of physical destruction and mechanical repression than are the terrorist groups. Okay? If that is so, where does it leave the revolution? Is it rendered impossible by the state of affairs? Not at all. For the revolution is not a simple aggregate of the mechanical means. The revolution can arise only out of the sharpening of the class struggle, and it can find guarantee of victory only in the social functions of the proletariat. The mass political strike, the armed insurrection, the conquest of state power. All this is determined by the degree to which production has been developed, the alignment of class forces, the proletariat's social weight, and finally by the social composition of the army, since the armed forces are a factor that in time of revolution determines the fate of the state power. Social democracy is realistic enough not to try to avoid the revolution. that is developing out of the existing historical conditions. On the contrary, it is moving to meet the revolution with eyes wide open. But contrary to the anarchists and in direct struggle against them, social democracy rejects all methods and means that have as their goal to artificially force the development of society and to substitute chemical preparations for the insufficient revolutionary strength of the proletariat. Before it is elevated to the level of a method of political struggle, terrorism makes its appearance in the form of individual acts of revenge. Yeah, I noticed.
Is it on?
Yeah, it's okay. Is it on again?
Flashing green.
Okay. Well, Lila was just telling me that I'm hoping that I haven't lost. No, that's okay. I'm glad you told me, because I may have lost my connection. I'm going to, if you hold on, I'm sorry for the, excuse me, I'm sorry here. I may have very well lost my application for my switchboard. Something happened there, and with the internet. So I apologize for that interruption, and we'll go back right now to the article. The arms insurrection, the conquest of state and power, all this is determined by the degree to which production has been developed. Alignment of, I think I've read that. But. Social democracy is realistic enough not to try to avoid the revolution that is developing out of the existing historical conditions. On the contrary, it is moving to meet the revolution with eyes wide open. But contrary to the anarchists and the direct struggle against them, social democracy rejects all methods and means that have as their goal to artificially force development of society and to substitute chemical preparation. I read this, and I apologize. Hang on one second here. I'm going to go up to... Okay, before it is elevated to the level of a method of political struggle, terrorism makes its appearance in the form of individual acts of revenge. So it was. Russia, the classic land of terrorism. The flogging of political prisoners impelled Vera Zasulich to give expression to the general feeling of indignation by an assassination attempt by General Trepov. Her example was imitated in the circles of the revolutionary intelligentsia, who lacked any mass support. What began as an act of unthinking revenge was developed into an entire system of, in 1879 to 1881, the outbreak of anarchist assassination in Western Europe and North America always come after some atrocity committed by the government. The shootings of strikers, the executions of political opponents. The most important psychological source of terrorism is always the feeling of revenge in search of an outlet. There is no need to belabor the point that social democracy has nothing in common with those bought and paid for moralists who, in response to any terrorist attack, make solemn declarations about the absolute value of human life. These are the same people who, on other occasions, in the name of other absolute values, for example, the nation's honor or the monarch's prestige, are ready to shove millions of people into the hell of war. Today, their national hero is the minister who gives the sacred right of private property, and tomorrow, when the desperate hand of unemployed workers is clenched into a fist or picks upon a weapon, they will start in with all sorts of nonsense about the inadmissibility of violence in any form. We see that today. We see that constantly in our own country. This same reaction and these same, unemployed people are pissed off. This dispossessed people, but yet you're seeing these desperate acts of terrorism around the country. But it's met with major resistance from police and government forces, and of course the social movement which spawned this kind of activity becomes weakened, becomes embarrassed and becomes hunted down, if you will, and instigated or investigated and so on, by these acts of stupid violence. And whatever the eunuchs and Pharisees of morality may say, the feeling of revenge has its rights. It does the working class the greatest moral credit that it does not look with vacant indifference upon what is going on in this best of all possible worlds. Not to extinguish the proletariat's unfulfilled feeling of revenge, but on the contrary, to stir it up again and again, to deepen it and to direct it against the real causes of all injustice and human baseness. That is the task of social democracy. If we oppose terrorist acts, it is only because individual revenge does not satisfy us. The account we have to settle with the capitalist system is too great to be presented to some functionary called a minister. To learn to see all the crimes against humanity, all the indignities to which the human body and spirit is subjected, as the twisted outgrowths and expression of the existing social system, in order to direct our energies into a collective struggle against this system, that is the direction in which the burning desire for revenge can find its highest moral satisfaction. And that's the end of the first essay by Leon Trotsky. And I so agree with what he's saying, We see it today. We definitely see it today. And no question about it. It's there. Now, the next essay was by Trotsky is called The Bankruptcy of Individual Terrorism. This article was written following sensational exposure about Yevno Azev, a prominent leader of a terrorist combat organization of the Russian Social Revolutionary Party. In 1909, Azev was exposed as an agent of the Tsarist secret police. In the course of his work as an agent provocateur, Azev had been responsible for the assassination of the minister of the Department of State, which employed him. He killed his own boss. All right. Trotsky's article analyzes this episode from the point of view of the social democracy, which at this time based itself on Marxism and raises some of the fundamental theoretical questions involved. For a whole month, the attention of everyone who was able to read and reflect at all, both in Russia and throughout the world, has been focused on Azov. His case is known to one and all from the legal newspapers and from accounts of the Duma debates over the demand raised by Duma deputies from an interpellation about Azov. Now, Azov has had time to recede into the background. His name appears less and less frequently in the newspapers. However, before once and for all leaving Azov to the garbage heap of history, we think it necessary to sum up the main political lessons, not as regards the mechanizations of Azov's type per se, but with regard to terrorism as a whole and to the attitude held toward it by the main political parties in the country. Individual terrorism as a method for political revolution is our Russian national contribution. Of course, the killing of tyrants is almost as old as the institution of tyranny itself, and poets of all centuries have composed more than a few hymns in honor of the liberating dagger. But systematic terror, taking as its task the elimination of satrap after satrap, minister after minister, monarch after monarch, saska after saska, which is a diminutive referring to the two czars, Alexander and the second, and Alexander the third, in the 1880s. As an 1880s Narodnaya Volya, people's will, which meant people's will, formulated the program for terror. This kind of terror, adjusting itself to absolutism, bureaucratic hierarchy, and creating its own revolutionary bureaucracy, is the product of the unique creative power of the Russian intelligentsia. Of course, there must be deep-seated reasons for this, and we should seek them, first in the nature of the Russian autocracy, and second in the nature of the Russian intelligentsia. Before the very idea of destroying absolutism by mechanical means could acquire popularity, the state apparatus had to be seen as a purely external organ of coercion, having no roots in the social organization itself. And this is precisely how the Russian autocracy appeared to the revolutionary intelligentsia. This illusion had its own historical basis. Tsarism took shape under the pressure of the more culturally advanced states of the West. In order to hold its own in competition, it had to bleed the popular masses dry, and in doing so, it cut the economic ground from under the feet of even the most privileged classes. And these classes were not able to raise themselves to the high political level attained by the privileged classes in the West. To this, in the 19th century, was added the powerful pressure of the European Stock Exchange. The greater the sum it loaned to the Tsarist regime, the less Tsarism depended directly upon the economic relations within the country. By means of European capital, it armed itself with European military technology, and it thus grew into a self-sufficient, in a relative sense, of course, organization, elevating itself above all classes of society. But a situation could naturally give rise to the idea of bashing this extraneous superstructure into the air with dynamite. I want to mention this again because I see the parallel between our system here in the United States, depending on Europe and China to buy our loans, to lend us money, their capital, rather than depend on our own taxes and our own people and our own initiative. Instead, we're borrowing from overseas. So, in essence, it isolates our government from responding to its own people. And that's what happened in the Tsarist Russia, okay? And how the revolution began because of the separation and the isolation of the Tsar and the government to its own people. Such a situation naturally gave rise to the idea of blasting the extraneous superstructure into the air with dynamite, okay? Which is how people feel today. The Russian head of the country's level of economic intelligentsia had developed under the direct, immediate pressure of the West, like their enemy, the state. They rushed ahead of the country's level of economic development. The state, technologically, the intelligentsia, ideologically. Whereas in the older bourgeois societies of Europe, revolutionary ideas developed more or less parallel with the development of the broad revolutionary forces. In Russia, the intelligentsia gained access to the ready-made cultural and political ideas of the West and had their thinking revolutionized before the economic development of the country had given birth to serious revolutionary classes from which they could get support. Under these conditions, nothing remained for the intelligentsia but to multiply the revolutionary enthusiasm by the explosive force of nitroglycerin. So arose the classical terrorism of Narodia Volnia. The terror of the social revolutionaries was by and large a product of those same historical factors. The self-sufficient despotism of the Russian state, on the one hand, and the self-sufficient Russian revolutionary intelligence, Sadgentsia, on the other. But 2 decades did not go by without having some effect. And by the time the terrorists of the second wave appear, they do so as epigons, are marked with the stamp outdated by history. The epic of capitalist Sturm und Drang, or Storm and Stress, of the 1880s and 1890s, produced and consolidated a large industrial proletariat, making serious inroads into the economic isolation of the countryside and linking it more closely with the factory and the city. Behind Narodnaya Volya, there really was no revolutionary class. The social revolutionary literature stating they pose terror not instead of the mass struggle, but together with it. But these quotations bear witness only to the struggle the ideologists of terror have had to conduct against Marxists, the theoreticians of mass struggle. But this does not change matters. By its very essence, terrorist work demands such concentrated energy for the great moment, such an overestimation of the significance of individual heroism, and finally, such a hermetic conspiracy that if not logically, psychologically, it totally excludes agitational and organizational work among the masses. So, in other words, he's stating that, you know, you need organization, and if you have these terrorist units, they're striking out on their own rather than, you know, organizing, and they're ignoring the people, and of course that's what happened. And that's what, you know, that's why people like Trotsky were exiled under Stalin, because he believed in forced hand terrorist actions and everything else, and, you know, he became the ruler that way, but it was, you know, to the destruction and dismay and the death of millions and millions of people. For terrorists in the entire field of politics, there exists only 2 central focuses: the government and the combat organization. The government is ready to temporarily reconcile itself to the existence of all other currents. Gershuni, a founder of the Combat Organization of Social Revolutionaries, wrote to his comrades at a time when he was facing the death sentence. And he says, and he quotes, "But it has decided to direct all its blows toward crushing the Social Revolutionary Party. I sincerely trust," said Kaliev, another social revolutionary terrorist, writing at a similar moment, that our generation, headed by the combat organization, will do away with the autocracy. And everything that is outside the framework of terror is only the setting for the struggle, at best an auxiliary means in this blinding flash of exploding bombs. The contours of political parties and the dividing lines of the class struggle disappear without a trace. And we hear the voice of that greatest of romantics and the best practitioners of the new terrorism, Grishuni, urging his comrades to avoid a break with not only the ranks of the revolutionaries, but even a break with the opposition parties in general. So here's a guy, who's getting ready for the firing squad, and he's saying, don't break with the ranks of the revolutionaries, and don't go out there and try yourself. Or even a break with the opposition parties in general. In other words, not instead of the masses, but together with them. However, terrorism is too absolute a form of struggle to be content with a limited and subordinate role in the party. Engendered by the absence of a revolutionary class, regenerated later by a lack of confidence in the... engendered in the absence of a revolutionary class, regenerated later by a lack of confidence in the revolutionary masses. Terrorism can maintain itself only by exploiting the weakness and disorganization of the masses, minimizing their conquest and exaggerating their defeats. They see that it is impossible, given the nature of modern armaments, for the popular masses to use pitchforks and cudgels, those age-old weapons of the people, to destroy the Bastilles of modern times. Defense attorney Zadnov said of the terrorists during the trial of Kalayev, after January 9th, the Bloody Sunday massacre, which marked the start of the 1905 revolution, they saw very well what was involved. And they answered the machine gun and rapid-fire rifle with the revolver and the bomb. Such are the barricades of the 20th century. The revolvers of individual heroes instead of the people's cudgels and pitchforks, bombs instead of barricades, that is the real formula of terrorism. And no matter what sort of subordinate role terror is relegated to by the synthetic theoreticians of the party, it always occupies a special place of honor, in fact. And the combat organization, which the official party hierarchy places under the Central Committee, inevitably turns out to be above it, above the party in all its work, until cruel fate places it under the police department. And that is precisely why the collapse of the combat organization as a result of a police conspiracy inevitably means the political collapse of a party as well. And that he ends up there. But the idea, of course, as we see it, is the bankruptcy. The bankruptcy of individual terrorism. And the first was the Marxist supposed individual terrorism. Then I'm going to end tonight with this essay from Peter Taff, who wrote for the Militant, and it's Marxism Opposes Individual Terrorism is the name of his article. Same title basically, but This article was written in November 7th, 1975, by Peter T-A-A-F-F-E. Hardly a day now passes without a political assassination, attempted assassination, kidnapping, or bombing taking place somewhere in the world. Now, this was in 1975 when he wrote this, and this is happening today, the same thing. The Harima kidnapping in Ireland is only the most recent example of what has become almost a world epidemic. The exploits of the seemingly endless array of guerrilla groups, the Basque Nationalists, ETA, the Argentinian ERP, and Montoneros, the American SLA, which was the Sinhalese Liberation Army, and the Provisional IRA, to mention some of the best known, seem to be continually in the news. All of these terror groups, some may still be existing, but they've all been replaced by other fundamentalist groups, patriot groups, Middle Eastern groups, Al-Qaeda's and Hamas and all these things. So these are the new names. But the exploits of the seemingly endless array of guerrilla groups, counter-terrorist apparatus there, has been the predictable reaction of the ruling class to this threat. Denunciation combined with the bolstering of their counter-terrorist apparatus have been the predictable reaction by governments. But condemnation sits uneasily on their lips. Violence and terrorism against the people of the world. Witness the recent barbarism of American imperialism. 10% of the population of Cambodia, for instance, was wiped out. Then there is the international balance of terror. Science and technique are used to perfect fiendish weapons of destruction, enough to kill every human being on the planet a number of times over, while millions of face starvation. The fireball bomb, capable of setting whole cities alight in the most recent triumph of science in its field, and that's the phosphorus bomb, okay, which has been used in Fallujah and has been used in Afghanistan recently as well. But perhaps the most nauseating example of the hypocrisy of the capitalists was the condemnation of terrorism by the butcher Franco and his supporters. He rode to power over the bones of a million workers and peasants and enslaved Spanish people for 40 years. The mushrooming of individual terrorist groups is on the one side a system of the growing revolt against capitalism on a world scale. But on the other side, it reflects the lack of authority of the leadership of the Communist Party and the labor leaders in the eyes of a section of youth, particularly middle-class youth, who are looking for a way to overthrow lordism, landlordism, and capitalism. They were repelled by the opportunism of those leaders and seek a shortcut in single combat with the capitalist state. Yet their actions have the opposite effect of that intended. The capitalist state is enabled to strengthen itself by introducing repressive measures under the guise of fighting terrorism. Man, this speaks to so much to today. You know, this was written in 1975. Repelled by the actions of the individual terrorists, the workers are also driven behind the leaders of the mass organizations, thus strengthening these leaders. And not infrequently, individual terrorist campaigns end up in the installation of military dictatorship, as was the case with Tupamaros in Uruguay. Many of these groups claim to be Marxist, and there are even some alleged to be Trotskyites. As in Spain today and Argentina only yesterday, who justify these methods, usually from the sidelines. But from its inception, Marxism has combated the ideas of individual terrorism. It has done so not for pacifist reasons, but because it believes that the method of individual terrorists are harmful forms of struggle against capitalism. Marxism starts with the fundamental idea that the liberation of the working class and the yoke of capital is the task of the working class itself. Only those methods which facilitate this task, which assist the working class to raise its level of understanding and make it conscious of its power to change society, can be justified. But in common with liberals, the individual terrorist believes that the capitalist system rests on individuals. They overestimate the role of the individual minister, policeman, or capitalist. The liberal strives for a position of influence as a minister, etc., in order to effect change. The individual terrorist stalks the representatives of the capitalist state with bomb and bullet, believing he can overthrow or prepare the downfall of capitalism. But the capitalist system does not rest on individuals and cannot be destroyed with them. Tory luminary Lord Hailsham recently indicated this. When I was in cabinet, we did say to one another that if anything is done to any of us, he was expendable and expended. I think that was right. And, you know, that's exactly what happens today, you know, in the elite and in the ruling classes. They know they're expendable. You know, if they get assassinated or, you know, something happens, they're expendable. There's a vice president. There's a vice chairman that takes his place. There's, you know, other people. And they understand this. And you got to understand, too, if you frig up, if you screw up in these cabinet circles, you're dead meat. You know, you're out the door. And you're history. But the capitalists will always find new men to replace those who are assassinated. At the same time, they invariably use actions of the individual terrorists to bridle the working class with further repressive legislation. Individual terrorists or urban guerrillas substitute themselves for the masses. They believe that it is their action, not the conscious organization of the masses, which will effect the necessary change. They actually lower the masses in their own consciousness, reconcile them to impotence, and direct their glances to the greater avenger and emancipator who will someday come to the accomplish his mission. That was a quote by Trotsky, by the way. I guess I didn't realize I was quoting Trotsky there. I'm sorry. There was the experience of the Russian Revolution is the best answer for the ideas of individual terrorism. Russian Marxism has fought against the proponents of individual terror for decades before the revolution. The terrorists who only assassinated known torturers, hated policemen and executioners, were in the most case self-sacrificing heroes, although mistaken in their methods. Can the same thing be said today about those who leave bombs to indiscriminately maim and injure the innocent under the guise of fighting imperialism? Tsarism was overthrown by the mass mobilization and arming of Russian workers and peasants under the guidance of the Bolsheviks. Once in power, mass terror and armed police was used to hold down and defeat the counter-revolution organized by the dispossessed landlords and their international supporters. The ruling classes of Britain, France, USA, etc., even the defeated 1905 revolution, had so illuminated the effectiveness of the mass action as compared to the puny efforts of the individual terrorists that the influence of terrorism waned. Thus Trotsky would write in 1905. Interesting thing, too, you know, that Sam Adams, you know, who was the American terrorist of all terrorists, beginner of the and instigator of the Boston Massacre. All right. After the, you know, he later, once the United States became a state, a country, he stated that, you know, he made certain, he made certain that nobody could rise up against the revolution. He stated the same thing, okay, in 1776. They passed laws and went after Shays. In fact, Shays' Rebellion, you know, was put down by Washington and the others. And that was a rebellion against the, actually, the Whiskey Rebellion. But Shays' Rebellion was against the established new government, your new American government. So we did the same. I mean, all revolutions basically do the same thing. You know, there's a revolution, and then they go into, and then they put down any other revolution against their revolution. And fascinating. But let me go back to this. Ostrovsky would write in 1905, terrorism in Russia is dead. Terror has migrated to the East. But in Russia, it is already part of the heritage of history. It was the Bolsheviks and the leaders like Lenin and Trotsky who ensured that the advanced workers understood the correct lessons from the Russian Revolution. There has been no shortage of examples of the colossal power of the working class in those countries where the ideas of individual terrorism hold sway over a section of the youth. But what has been lacking is a mass organization and leadership capable of drawing all the necessary conclusions. And Argentina today provides a classic example of this. This is back again in 1975. There have been guerrillas organizations, principally the ERP and Montoneros, undoubtedly are composed of self-sacrificing opponents of Argentine landlordism and capitalism. But the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Albeit unwillingly, they have exercised a baleful effect on the course of the Argentinian Revolution. The guerrillas conducted a violent campaign against the junta, which was replaced by the Peronist candidate in March 1973. But it was the fear of the masses, not the action of the guerrillas, which compelled the Argentine landlords and capitalists to switch from the military junta to Peronism. The temper of the Argentine workers has been demonstrated in the virtual insurrectionary general strike which preceded the overthrow of the junta. The guerrilla campaign temporarily subsided following Perón's ascension to power. But but with his death, it was started up again with renewed ferocity, first by the ERP and then by some of the young Peronists in the Montoneros. And we forget about these for some reason. I don't know why. History is easy to forget. And spectacular kidnappings were undertaken by the ERP and Montoneros. For instance, the Born brothers, chairman and managing director of Bungie Y. Born, one of the world's largest grain dealers, was kidnapped by the Montoneros and only released on payment by the firm of $60 million ransom. The Montoneros also stipulated that $1 million worth of food and clothing were be distributed to poor as punishment for the supply shortages which the company inflicted on the people. Yeah, it's funny they didn't give them back to say they didn't give the $60 million to the poor. Actions like this reveal the gulf separating Marxism from guerrilla groups. Marxism, scientific socialism, sees the task of the working class as a struggle to remove the causes of exploitation, misery, and poverty by eliminating, through the socialist revolution, private ownership of the means of production. The guerrillas merely seek compensation for the masses for the crimes of capitalism, and thus their philosophy is that of Robin Hood, robbing the rich to help the poor, rather than out of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Trotsky. At the same time, in the last year, the ERP, together with the Montoneros, have restated the assassination campaign against army generals, police torturers, and so on. This article goes on, and I'm going to recommend it highly to those of you who are interested to go to it. You can receive it. You can go to Militant Pamphlet, Marxism Opposes Individual Terrorism, articles by Leon Trotsky and Peter Taft. Very, very, very good material for the classroom or for anyone to really see what communism is, as opposed to what Marxism is, you know, by its theorists, and in its relationship to terrorism. And you know, everybody thinks, oh, you know, communism, terrorism, anything ism other than capitalism is the same thing and should be shunned. But this is it would be wise for anybody looking at our system today looking at what's going on today in terrorist societies and in individual terrorism, to read these. And again, you know, you can go to, you can look up this PDF. It's called, it's very difficult to get to the top of this now. Marxism opposes individual terrorism. You can Google that up and see what comes up. And, yeah, Marxism opposes individual terrorism. And you can look up Peter Taffe, T-A-A-F-F-E, and Leon Trotsky. Right? And with that, I'm going to conclude tonight's show. Thank everybody. Thank everybody for listening. And I hope you enjoyed the show. And join us again next Tuesday night. We won't be on tomorrow night. Friday we have the night off. And I hope you enjoy the weekend, the Memorial weekend. And tell your friends about us. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. And have a good night.